Hello, tech fans, and welcome into episode 151 of the Tech Sideline podcast, originating from TSL's High Tech Studios in the Virginia Tech Corporate Research Center. On today's show, a one-point heartbreaking loss for the Hokies to then-ranked number 9 Miami on Saturday inside of Lane Stadium. What does it all mean for the Hokies? We answer that question on episode 151 of the Tech Sideline podcast that gets started right now. Whether you're watching live or archived on YouTube, listening on Apple Podcast, SoundCloud, Amazon Music, Spotify, Google Podcast, or on Stitcher, so many great ways to consume the Tech Sideline podcast. So glad you could join us as we record on Monday morning, November the 16th. We have our managing editor, Chris Coleman, with us on the podcast set, as well as our founder and general manager, Will Stewart. We've got Malcolm Stewart, the Tech Sideline podcast producer, behind the scenes, making the magic happen. And I am your podcast host, Evan Hughes. This week and every week, the Tech Sideline podcast is presented by the Fisher Law Firm, Virginia's trusted DUI and traffic defense firm, dedicated to defending individuals charged with traffic-related offenses. The Fisher Law Firm handles cases throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia. To date, the firm has defended tens of thousands of people charged with moving violations. For free consultation, call anytime, day or evening, toll-free at 1-800-680-7031. Again, that's 1-800-680-7031. Or you can email the Fisher Law Firm at info@fisherlegal.com. Reminder, if you're watching live on YouTube this morning, we invite you to chime in the chat. Feel free to write a comment, or if you have a question for Will or Chris, we will read them at the end of the show. Gentlemen, good morning to you. Episode 151 of the Tech Sideline podcast. How was your weekend, and how are you doing?
Not bad. Spent about 6 hours in my garage yesterday. So Monday Thoughts is going to be a little late today.
Chris Coleman, how are you?
Normal weekend. I'm good.
You know, here's a question for you guys. When Virginia Tech wins or loses, does it change the way the weekend goes for you?
It used to. It doesn't anymore. I've actually, from a professional standpoint, I've enjoyed this season because, like, I've been able to detach myself emotionally because I'm not in the stadium around emotional people. I tweet a little bit during the game, but generally I don't read Twitter. Don't read the responses. Don't read the boards very much at all. I just immediately start my column after the game. There's no outside noise for me, like, clouding my views on things. It's just, here's what I think, right? So I've actually enjoyed it to a certain, from that standpoint. I'm able to take, like, Sundays off completely this year. So I'm thinking, like, the fan in me wants to go back and tailgate and go to games again. But at that point, when you do that, you don't have a single day off during the week. So I might just, like, might keep doing what I'm doing in future seasons just to have a week, a day off on Sundays. But anyway, that's beside
you'd have
point.
A day off to work on your garage for 5 to 6 hours. Will, can you tell us a little bit about what you had to do in your garage yesterday? Was it fun stuff or was it work stuff?
Well, I'm kind of weird. I like cleaning stuff up and making stuff look better. So I got pictures on my phone of the before and the after. You know, not to delve too far into it, but we're having a storage closet built in our garage, which required us to consolidate stuff that's in front of both cars over in front of the one car where the closet is not being built. So to Chris's point, my season hasn't really been any different. It has been different from the standpoint that I've been in the press box. I haven't been in the press box since Frank's last year, 2015. And, you know, we had Ricky LeBlue working up there for a couple of years, and we've had students doing it since then. But with limited media in the press box, they said they want the full-time paid employees of for-profit enterprises to be the ones that are in the press box. So that means no students. So I've had to go up there and work the games myself. And I've gone back and forth on staying after the game and participating in the post-game interviews. I think I did it for one of the games. How many home games have we had? Three? Four?
Four.
I think for the first one, I participated in post-game interviews, but that's just not really my thing. That's not what I do. And we have students like Jake Lyman writes up all of the post-game quotes. I don't have particularly insightful questions to ask after the game. I just don't. You know, I haven't had the time to absorb everything yet. I think other media members are a lot better about that. I think they take notes and they decide which athletes they want to request and what questions they want to ask the coach and things like that. That's just not my thing. So the last couple games, I've actually just packed up and left right after the game was over. But, you know, I helped put together the recap. Corey Van Dyke writes it up, and I'm the one who does all the graphics and the formatting and the embedding of the videos and tying it into all the schedules. I do all that. So I'm working all day Saturday. A lot of the day Sunday, like I work every Sunday night. And that gets, you know, particularly at my age, that gets pretty fatiguing after a while, especially when they don't have any weekends off. You know, they're just boom, 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 playing every weekend. You know, I think we got three more games, and you know, I got to be honest, from a personal standpoint, it'll be nice to switch off the tap at that point in time. But to Chris's point, the emotion of it hasn't really been getting to me this year like it usually does. And I don't know that I'm waffling on that statement because we do get subjected to that blast all day long on Twitter and all day long on the message boards. And this isn't true of our subscriber board. Our subscriber board has been pretty good about talking about things and discussing the issues, but you just can't be on Twitter and Facebook right now. Every single tweet from the Hokie football Twitter account now, Hokies FB, the responses are fire Fuente, fire Fuente, fire Fuente, fire Cornelison, fire Cornelison. You know, they put up Pete Morris tweets out yesterday. I don't know, one of the tech players in the NFL did something good, and he gets answered with fire Fuente, fire Fuente. You know, you just cannot
be on it. And it's toxic, and it puts you in a bad mood. And if you think recruiting is bad right now, like recruits, their window into the world is social media.
Yeah.
So when they get on there and see stuff like that, they're like, oh, all their fans want Fuente fired. I'm not going to Virginia Tech.
Yeah, notice what he just said. All their fans want Fuente fired. That's not true.
Right. But that's what it seems like on Twitter.
The perception. Right?
Yeah.
So it's a toxic situation. And honestly, it's not any fun to think about. But here we are. We're going to spend the next hour talking about it. So
let me make a point while we're on the topic. You know, and this is right off the top of my head, so don't at me if you disagree. But I was just sitting here thinking that, you know, the decision to let go of a coach is a little bit different decision these days than it was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, the big donors drove the bus, and I don't think athletic directors had an insight into what the fan base was thinking as much as they do now.
All they had to do is, like, just not open their mail if they wanted to ignore what the fans were thinking, right?
And when the tide turns against you on social media, that can be a driver in whether or not to keep a coach, because I'm looking for the proper phrase here, that changes the public perception of your program, as Chris just pointed out. So recruits, high school kids, are in general not on Twitter. They're on Instagram and Snapchat. But football players use it for recruiting. It's a big recruiting tool for them. You know, they put pictures up and they put video up. And that's how they really interface with coaches, is through Twitter. So football recruits are on Twitter. So you as an athletic director have to make the judgment call. Man, I don't know. I the fans are one thing, but this is poison for, you know, outside perception and recruiting. In 20 years ago, an athletic director might not pull the trigger, but in this day and age, they'll pull it quicker. So South Carolina got rid of Will Muschamp, you know, over the weekend. Their last two games were 48-3. They got pounded by Texas A&M, I think was the final score. And I watched, I got a son that goes to South Carolina, so I watched their game Saturday night, and they could not stop Ole Miss. You know, so they had given up 48 points last week and 59 this week, and you know, they just pulled the plug.
And here's the risk they run. And the risk Virginia Tech would run
if
they made any coaching changes. And maybe I wouldn't realize this in a normal year where I'm going to games and I'm around emotional people and everything like that. But this year, watching every single game by myself, I'm just more closed in. I feel like I'm thinking more rationally. But there's no guarantee there's going to be spring practice this year. Football season is getting played so athletic departments don't go under financially. Spring practice brings in no revenue for anybody, and it's not competitive. Like, there are no games, right? Anybody who got COVID this fall after, what is it, 120 days, 90 days, or whichever one of those.
I think it got changed to 120.
Okay, so that wears off. So
you got to get tested again.
So you got to get all this testing again. You could lose half your team to COVID in March, right? It would not shock me if there was no spring practice for anybody. So if you – I'm inclined to think they'll have it, but you at least have to
consider
the possibility that there will be no spring practice for anybody.
Yeah.
Or maybe even no spring practice for some states and spring practice for other states. Who the heck knows?
Because as somebody pointed out in your Friday Q&A article, this can be a state level and locality decision. It's not an NCAA decision.
Right. So if you think about if you fire a head coach, then you're changing an offensive system and a defensive system, and you're not going to have any spring practice to practice.
That is
systems.
A possibility.
So one of Florida State's issues this year is they change coaches in the offseason and they didn't have spring practice, right? LSU's defense
changed
coordinators
and offense.
Did they really?
Joe Brady left to be the Carolina Panthers offense coordinator.
Right. So LSU's not as good this year, and no spring practice with two new coordinators, right? They've particularly fallen off on defense, which they're still better than Virginia Tech's defense, but by LSU standards, they are horrible.
Yeah.
Virginia Tech's defense is obviously another example of what can happen when there's a new scheme and you don't get to practice it. I mean, if Virginia Tech changed head coaches right now, a new guy came in, I mean –
Recruits can't visit,
so you would not get to take advantage of the new car smell of a new coaching staff in recruiting. And then, quite frankly, the product you put on the field next year would probably be a disaster because they wouldn't get to practice the new schemes in the spring. And it's the same thing if you want Cornelson fired. You change offensive schemes and you don't get to practice it, then you'd be better off just keeping him once you got to the season next year and you're like, oh, my God. We're a disaster because we couldn't practice this offense in the spring. We should have just kept Cornelson.
So I will say this, though. What happened last March caught everybody with their pants down. So the season's going to end, you know, whether or not you go to a bowl game, I don't know. But when everybody comes back in January, the coaches are going to know that there's a possibility that spring practice might not happen. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's as good as having a spring practice, but there are things you can do to prepare for that eventuality. You know, you can at least have players go through drills somehow. I don't know. I don't want to get bogged down in the details of it. You can have Zoom meetings with them and accumulate film, and you can go over things in their heads. You can't do the physical reps, but at least you won't be sitting there on March 15th going, oh, crap, spring football just got canceled. You know, so it's a little different. It's still not good, though.
Some of the topics we're talking about right now, maybe not having spring practice, that is mentioned in Chris's article, which is up on the homepage of TechSideline.com right now. CC on Sunday, titled Hendon Hooker's Development and the Future of Brad Cornelson. We will reference that throughout the podcast. But we will break down the game on Saturday inside of Lane Stadium, a one-point game. Then number 9, Miami, a 25-24 win over Virginia Tech. It's Virginia Tech's 7th straight loss against an AP top 10 program. The Hokies are now 4-4 on the season. Chris, let me start with you. 1-point loss. Tech now 4-4 on the season. What should we take away from the Miami game?
You know, again, I don't think I learned anything new.
I think it was different from the standpoint that the linebacker play and the defensive tackle play was a lot better.
It was a lot better, but Miami only had 7 offensive linemen.
And I have not had a chance to look and see, you know, we have a roster card with the projected starting lineup. I haven't had a chance to look and see who actually started for
Miami. They were one test away on Friday night from not being able to play.
Yeah.
So Miami was down a bunch of players.
So you got to take that into
account. You have to take that with a grain of salt. Yeah. That being said, it was like, I picked us to score 27 points, right? So if Brian Johnson made that 54-yard field goal or whatever that he attempted, they would have scored exactly 55. The amount of points I would have predicted them to score. So from that standpoint, like, I can't be too disappointed. But the way it went down was disappointing.
I ran the numbers on, it Virginia Tech kicked a field goal with 6:14 to go in the third quarter. They were up 24-13. You felt like they were in charge. And a matter of fact, when they came back from the commercial, the play-by-play announcer said, you know, you just get the feeling that Virginia Tech has seized the momentum. And they didn't score again. And in their last five possessions, I ran the numbers last night, the Hokies gained 57 yards of offense. If you look in the drive chart, it'll tell you something different because there's penalties involved. They gained 57 yards of offense. They gained five first downs in the last five possessions, and two of those came off of Miami penalties, personal fouls and things like that, because that's Miami.
Zero gets a personal foul.
Who was the punter?
Five possessions, 57 yards, three first downs that you got on your own, 0 points, didn't cross midfield in the last four possessions. So, you know, guess who's in the crosshairs the rest of the weekend? Yeah. Offensive coordinator Brad Cornelison.
Richie Galmore actually tweeted at me minutes before the podcast, and he wanted to know, why did we only see three non-quarterback runs in the fourth quarter? Herbert, 2 carries, 11 yards. Robinson, a jet sweep for 5 yards. That's it, in all caps, for non-quarterback runs.
Well, some of that is Hendon keeping the ball on read options, you know, and scrambling off of passing plays, but... I am in the process of kind of analyzing everything because some of the criticism that came out during the game were the play calling on third and intermediate, 5, 6, 7 yards to go. I noticed Andy Bitter tweeting during the game that when Tech got down to that, down on Miami's side of the field in like the 35 to 40 yard line where you're just starting to come into field goal range, that they started struggling at that point. There were also criticisms of Raheem Blackshear not catching punts.
Yeah.
So I'm working on that. Personnel decisions with Jalen Holston running the way he was running. Oh. Why were they running Raheem Blackshear? So I think the book is getting out on Blackshear. And one of the things that I'll put in my article is, did you notice the toss sweep in this game? I don't think we'd seen that this year. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, it's the old school toss sweep where the quarterback – steps back and kind of throws that underhand toss out to the perimeter. They ran that with Blackshear, I think, 3 times. It wasn't very successful. And they ran it with Khalil Herbert once as well, I think, to put down on film. We're not just necessarily not going to do this, only going to do this with Blackshear. But so Blackshear, you know, they got him out in space a little bit or they made an effort, but they also ran him up the middle a lot, and he's just not good at that.
This was Justin Fuente's opening statement in the press conference on Saturday. He said, quote, "I feel better about our football team than at any point. We're not happy with not winning the ball game, but my gosh, did our guys lay it on the line today," close quote. Chris, what did you make of what he had to say postgame?
I generally ignore what most coaches say postgame because, you know, if you've ever covered a game, you know, especially like an NCAA tournament game, a big game, when you get the official printouts and they give you the timing of all the postgame interviews and things like that. And there's always like a 15-minute, what they call, cool down session. Right, because as emotional as we are as fans, most of us during games, I mean, it's even more so for coaches and players, yeah. Right? So they're way more emotionally invested than any of us. So honestly, you put guys in front of a microphone after an emotional win or an emotional loss, and you don't necessarily know what's going to come out of their mouth. Like Fuente's always been much, much better on Tech Talk Live. He's really comfortable around John Lazor, of course.
But and he's had a day.
He's had a day to process it, watch the film, and everything like that. No, he's not wrong. I mean, name me one thing about that statement that's wrong about Tech.
I thought a lot of his postgame comments were very calculated at complimenting the players' effort.
Absolutely.
I'm not saying he's wrong.
Right, right.
It's not a criticism. Right. You can just tell that was his agenda when he got in front of the mic.
It's the same thing as like. I don't know. I wrote in my article yesterday is like he's right. It doesn't mean that the loss still isn't discouraging, though. Yeah. So, I mean, every time Virginia Tech lost a football game back in the day, or they get into a bad stretch, or somebody would question the offense, I mean, Frank Beamer would get on Tech Talk Live and say, oh, we were one block away. We just lost our leverage on this play, on a play here and a play there, and you know, blah, blah, blah. That's what he said every time after a loss. And he was right most of the time. It didn't make
why does this keep happening?
Right. It didn't make it any less discouraging. So I think a lot of fans think that that what coaches say in front of a microphone after a game is what they say to players and other coaches and team meetings and things like that. And it's not. Trust me, I know it's not. I have heard a lot of stuff through various people about stuff Justin Fuente says when he's not in front of a microphone after games, and it's nothing like the stuff that gets reported. Mm-hmm. So I don't think much about it at all, to be honest with you.
So as we analyze the game, typically we start with the offense, but I thought today, breaking down the 25-24 win for Miami over Virginia Tech, we start with the defense for Hokies. Well, because as you said, the linebackers, the defensive line played much better. We kind of touched on this to begin with, but my first question to you about the defense is, given the stats that Dax Holyfield had, he led the team in tackles with 13, Ashby in double digits in tackles, Gerard Hewitt, 2.5 sacks, so much good. How much of that gets overshadowed by the fact that Miami was out their starting left tackle, their starting left guard, and as Chris said...
So you know who they were out. Yeah, you did the research.
They were one, you said, Chris, they were one offensive lineman away from not being
able to. It was their right guard who was the big issue, I thought.
Well, I remember going in, their center is the worst grading offensive lineman on their team.
Right.
So
credit to the defense, or does that get overshadowed given the circumstances?
Well, you know, you can't minimize what the defense. Like linebackers are, unless the offensive line is getting to the second level, linebackers aren't really affected much by the offensive line. Anybody who, you don't have to be an astute football observer to watch that game and think, Dax Holyfield played a really good game.
I haven't confirmed this on PFF, but I'm pretty sure that was his best game of his career, which 2 years in a row, man, like about halfway through last season when Tisdale was clearly outplaying him, I was like, look, it's got to be Tisdale. He's just better. And then Dax was much, much better in the second half of the season and outperformed Tisdale in the second half of the season. This year, you know, last week, gosh, Dax hasn't been good this year, and he was particularly bad last week. And I'll admit this, I texted somebody after the game, maybe even you, and I said, I think Dax is the worst starting linebacker we've ever had since I've been covering the team. And then he comes out the next week and...
See, you're getting into Lindell Gibson and Jake Johnson territory, man.
He comes out the next week and has the best game of his career.
I know.
So I don't know what to expect. But that's the thing if you're a coach, right?
It's maddening.
How do you know what to expect when your player can play? I think he probably played the second worst game of his career against Liberty behind the UNC game, and then he turns that around with the best game of his career. You just don't know what's going to happen.
He had 13 tackles, which was a career high.
Right. Yeah. Well, his tackling was so much better.
Yeah.
He was just playing.
I think
more,
I saw him miss
physical.
One tackle.
Right. And to the point about the offensive lineman being out, yes, it most certainly helped Tech. At the same time, like Liberty pushed him around the week before. And I know those were Miami's backups, but Liberty starters should not be as good as Miami's backups, right? So yes, Tech played much, much better this week than they did last week against Liberty. I'm glad, but at the same time, I'm still frustrated. I'm more frustrated, to be honest with you. And I think I closed my Liberty article saying, you know what, I wouldn't be all – I'm not picking Tech to beat Miami, but I wouldn't be all that surprised if they did.
But
if they do, that's just going to make the Liberty loss even more frustrating. Right. Well, Tech didn't beat Miami, but the sentiment is still sort of the same.
Right.
Will, sticking with the defense, I'm going to give you three players. You got to tell me who had the bigger day on Saturday.
All right.
Holyfield led the team in tackles with 13. Rayshard Ashby seemed like a bounce-back day after getting hurt against Liberty. 11 tackles, tied for second for most on the team in the loss. Or Gerard Hewitt with 2.5 sacks. Who had the biggest day of the three?
I would say Hewitt did. He was consistently disruptive. He was in the backfield. And I actually went over all this stuff. It's not a career high in tackles for loss. It's a season high in sacks and tackles for loss. He had 2.5 sacks, 2.5 tackles for loss. He had three at some point in another game. Definitely his best effort of the season. And I just think they both had really good games. But I think when a defensive tackle has a really good game, it's just way much more disruptive to an offense when the D tackles are playing well.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I really liked the game plan from Tech defensively. You know, we came into the game knowing that Derek King was really good. He'd burn a blitz, right? Yeah. So you can't just pin your ears back and blitz that guy all day. Tech mixed things up really well. I know at least one of Hewitt's sacks came on a twist stunt with the defensive end. Tech did blitz, but they didn't blitz heavy. They picked their spots. They mixed man and zone in the back end. I just thought it was a good mix. Fuente said after the game, we threw the kitchen sink at them.
Yes.
And I think a lot of times when coaches say that, it means, oh, we blitzed a lot. That's not the case here. Tech just did a whole lot of different things.
Well, I saw Narelle Pollard drop into coverage one time.
Right. So they had...
Which is common, but...
Yeah, so that was a mentally challenging game for the Tech defense because they were asked to do a whole lot of things, and they did a really good job.
They executed it really well.
Yeah.
You know, well, I felt like going from the Liberty game to the Miami game, and I know this is lost, but I felt like somebody who was a real winner from the day was Justin Hamilton. And kind of going off of Chris's point, I thought the game plan was exceptional. Is it fair to say that might have been his best game as defensive coordinator?
Well, yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure your average fan is going to pick up on that. I think your average fan is like, oh, the players played well.
Your average fan is obsessed with firing Brad Cornelson right now.
Well, that's true. They're not talking about Justin Hamilton. Yeah,
right. Sure.
You know, and he took a beating last week. Not as bad as Cornelson's taken this week. But, you know, Hamilton got some criticism last week. But I think he had a really good game. Chris talked about, you know, and so many of the players played so well, too. You know, better than they usually play. And
I was so – Breon Murray, again, he got benched against Liberty because he got burned on that opening drive.
Yeah.
And he hasn't played well this year. And then he comes out with the best game of his career against Miami.
Deflection on the pass in the end
good,
zone.
Good in coverage. Yeah.
So it's just like, man, I wish I knew which one of these guys was going to be reliable on a week-to-week basis.
Even Armani Chapman. How about that? There was a one-on-one ball down the middle of the field.
Right.
And he had a decent game as well. So.
And can we get the offense and the defense to show up for the same game?
So, again, there was a lot to, again Dax Hollyfield, 13 tackles. Ashby with 11 tackles. Devin Taylor, 11 tackles in this
game. So, by the way, I did a little bit of research last night, and I'll put this in my article today. Dax and Ashby led the team in tackles, and that is the first time since
Miami
a game in 2018.
That both linebackers?
It's not necessarily both linebackers because there were other games where Ashby and Tisdale last year led the team in tackles.
Right.
But this is the first time that Dax and Ashby have led the team, have been 1-2 in tackles. I can't remember the game in 2018. It was about midway through the 2018 season.
Last thing on the defense, then we'll transition to the offense. Jermaine Waller did not play this past week against Miami. He has only played against North Carolina and Liberty. Of course, about a year ago, Caleb Farley and Jermaine Waller were two of the best cornerback combos in the ACC. They might have even been the best in the country this year. Of course, Farley opted out for the draft. Waller's only played twice this year. Chris, should we expect Waller to be available down the stretch? And what should we make of what's – he's been battling an injury this year, correct?
He's played in 2 out of 8 games, one early in the season, one fairly recently. So I don't know. I don't know if he's going to play anymore or not. But even if he does, it doesn't matter. He's not the same player.
I don't mean to make this sound the way it's going to sound. But when it comes to the defense, I don't think of him anymore.
You're right.
He's not on my radar.
He's on the moon to me. It's like
I think about Murray. I think about Dorian Strong.
You know, look, if he shows up and he plays well, okay. But he's just kind of he's not the same player he was. I mean, and you wouldn't expect.
Right.
I believe it's a foot injury he's been dealing with.
Foot injury.
I think they've changed their tune, though. He came back from the foot injury, and he now has an upper body injury.
Of course. And what do you expect? Listen, I know you're trying to get better defensively, but he had that foot surgery in the offseason and then was home because of COVID and couldn't get the proper treatment for rehab and everything like that. So he came back still hurt, even though he had the surgery, not 100% in shape, couldn't practice very much in August. They threw him out there against North Carolina and play him basically the whole game. And Buzz Williams understood that. Buzz Williams had the kinesiology degree, where if you're not 100% over one injury, you were going to stress a different, even subconsciously, you were going to stress a different part of your body, protecting the injured part of your body. So he's protecting his foot because he's not 100% and pulls are growing as a result, right? So they played him too many snaps too soon.
So let me jump in here and say, old folks get this. Because one of their hips, for example, will start to go bad. So they'll start favoring that hip. And then they'll get hip replacement surgery on that hip. Mm-hmm. And then they'll realize they've been busy ruining the other hip. Favoring the bad hip.
Right.
So old people and football players, athletes.
So they brought him back way too early. Quite frankly, in a game Tech had no chance to win.
Yeah.
We could have a whole conversation about some of the medical decisions Tech has made, and this goes back to the Beamer era, like playing Ricky Walker. After he got hurt against Florida State a couple of years ago, they started him and played him against William & Mary the next week.
In a game they were going to win.
In a game they were going to win. In a game they didn't need him. And within five or six snaps, boom, he's out again, and he's on crutches on the sideline. And he was not the same player the rest of the season.
Yeah.
It arguably cost Tech at least one football game that year. I want to see better decisions going forward when it comes to stuff like that.
And we don't know where the breakdown is, or is it the players being untruthful? Is it the medical staff not doing a good job? Is it coaches pushing players back before they should? And Chris and I don't know that. We don't know. Why did DeShawn Crawford play two snaps against NC State and then basically not be able to play for weeks?
Right.
Now, as we talked about previously, DeShawn said, that's my fault. Well, okay, players are going
to... Sometimes you have to protect a player from himself.
And I said on our message boards, it works both ways. There have been players that have been ready to play and then have said they're not. Mm-hmm. And Damon Hazelton is a classic example of that.
Well, I guess. Here's the thing. If you're Damon Hazelton, you saw firsthand what happened to Ricky Walker the year before, right? So...
Yeah. Again, we don't know because we're not there.
I think there's a disconnect there, and I think there's a lot of things in our football program that have to be taken. I mean, everybody, like, it's easy to sit there and say, like, "Oh, that play call was wrong," so that's why we lost the game. Maybe we lost the game because all our players are always hurt, or they're just some of them on defense just aren't big enough, or too big in one case.
Some guys aren't dedicated in the weight room. Some are.
Right. Or maybe it's because our quarterbacks aren't developing. Look, I mean, people talk about – I know the play people want to criticize is the 3rd-and-7 run with Hendon Hooker, right? Here's the thing. Hendon Hooker is a really good quarterback in great situations, like when Tech is running the ball and they're in front of the chains. In bad situations, he's not a good quarterback. 3rd-and-7 – I mean, look, there's enough evidence now that we know that Hendon Hooker is not a good quarterback in situations where the other team knows Virginia Tech is going to throw the ball. So Virginia Tech's coaches know that. So when they run the ball with him on 3rd-and-7, it's to try to pick up 4 yards, and they were at the position on the field where they can go for it on 4th down.
And either a coach or Kelly Stouffer, the analyst, made that comment during the game. He said, that play call is not about getting the first down.
Right.
It's about getting closer and trying for
it, which it didn't work. But like asking Hendon to drop back and pass on 3rd-and-long is a low percentage play because he's not good at it.
And let me say, it's not all his fault. Wide receivers are not getting separation.
Let me go back to my point. Okay, so it's not a bad play call based on Hooker's strengths. So my issue with Cornelson is not a play call. My issue is, why is Hendon Hooker not developed to the point where you have to call a running play on 3rd-and-7.
Yeah.
right? That's my issue with Cordell Nelson, is he a quarterback developer? And I know he did not have
spring practice.
But if you look back at his past quarterbacks at Tech, you know, Willis dropped off a cliff. Jackson was kind of the same guy when he, in his second year before he got hurt. I just don't see quarterbacks developing from one year to the next under him. And there's not enough evidence there with Hooker because they didn't have spring practice, but there's enough evidence there with the two guys before him. So that's my worry. Like, Cornelson would be able to call – like, Cornelson's options are limited on that play because Hooker's not a good passer unless Tech's ahead of the chains and they're running the football really well. But that might also be Cornelson's fault, that Hooker's not developed to the point where he has more options, more play options to call on third down.
There has been consistency on the coaching on the offensive side of the ball for the last 5 years. There has not been, you know, on the defensive side. And I'll just leave that out there. This, you know, people talk about there's the 50,000-foot view. This is Justin Fuente's fifth year, and they're 4-4 with a loss to Liberty. And then you start drilling down into the minutiae of, oh, they're just starting over on defense, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they're not starting over on offense. This staff, with a couple of changes, has been here. They've been recruiting to this system and developing within this system for 5 years now.
Well, you get into your article again, CC on Sunday, Hendon Hooker's development in the future of Brad Cornelson, transition down defense to offense. I think we could wrap this up here. Listen, you talk about the boards and Twitter and how negative it can be, and there's no doubt that it feels like, for years, it feels like Brad Cornelson gets all of this flack on social media, and especially in the last couple of weeks. Keep in mind, this is an offense, and Khalil Herbert, who at one point was leading the country in rushing yards per game, an offense that was putting up high 30s, low 40s. Simple question, is the criticism from the fan base fair on Brad Cornelson?
I'll answer it this way, a couple of different ways. Number one, that is the life of the offensive coordinator. Because as we've said a million times, if the play works, it's a great play call. If it doesn't work, it's a terrible play call. And that's how most fans react. Most fans, me included, can't really break stuff down X's and O's. So that's the life of an offensive coordinator, even when things are going well. The criticism, as you see it amplified through social media, is probably a little bit too harsh. Because you're right. I sit there and throughout the course of a game, I watch the game, and it's common to say, man, that was a really nice play call. Did you see that play design? That was nice.
Yeah.
But then you get down to the end of the game and 5 possessions, 0 points, you barely get on the other side of the field, you know, and that's the 50,000-foot view, you know, without getting bogged down in the details. The guy does some things well. He's not a complete train wreck. We've seen complete train wrecks at offensive coordinator for Virginia Tech.
He can actually design an offense around the strengths and weaknesses of his quarterback.
He does a pretty good job getting the most out of his players. There's a little something missing there.
Right.
You look at the points this year. NC State, 45 points. Duke, 38 points. North Carolina, 45 points. Boston College, 40 points. 16 to Wake Forest, 42 points Louisville, 35 points Liberty, 24 points Miami.
Yeah. I think the criticism is fair, but it's misplaced. Virginia Tech's entire offense is – remember when they basically changed offenses between Willis and Hooker last year when they made that switch?
Yeah.
And I think we see now why they were hesitant to put Hooker in there, because he's just not an advanced passer at all. So the whole offense is designed to protect his weaknesses. And – he doesn't have many, but the one he has is a massive, massive flaw. Like, he has no internal clock in the passing game. He's slow to read defenses. So when you get behind and the other team knows you're going to throw it, you're in an awful lot of trouble. So Virginia Tech's entire offensive scheme is designed to try to keep them out of
that
situation.
Yeah.
But if they do get behind and you have to go to that, you're done. So Cornelson's been great at protecting Hooker's weaknesses, but there are sometimes when those weaknesses flat out are going to be exposed. So I think for what his goal for trying to make the offense most efficient as possible under Hooker, he's done a great job. Now, where I criticize him is, well, why hasn't Hooker or past Virginia Tech quarterbacks, why didn't they take a step forward throughout the course of their career in the passing game? Mm-hmm. I think if Hendon Hooker had advanced more since his enrollment at Virginia Tech, if he was a more advanced passer at this stage, then you know, you don't have to do as much of that. You don't have to protect him as much. You don't have to use the smoke and mirror approach as much as you do. And you put yourself in a position where you're able to call a wider variety of plays and things like that. So I think Cornelson, from an offensive coordinating standpoint, is fine. From a quarterback coaching standpoint, I have some serious doubts.
Starting to wonder. Yeah. Okay. So if you look at what was working earlier in the year, Khalil Herbert was 100% healthy. I still don't think he was on Saturday.
No, and
the running game was working very well. And you know, you'd have to go do a deep dive into the numbers, but keeping Tech generally out of third and long. And if you look at Saturday's game, Jalen Phillips lived in Virginia Tech's backfield Saturday. He disrupted a lot of stuff, 4.5 tackles for loss, I think.
And 2.5 sacks.
So Jerod Hewitt was on his way to getting defensive lineman of the week, but Jalen Phillips happened. Yeah. You know, he as Mark Packer says, he ate Luke Tenuta's lunch, you know. So you've got that going on, and it tends to put you behind the chains some, and it puts Tech in an uncomfortable position offensively. And that's just the difference. That's what was working earlier in the season that wasn't working Saturday.
Yeah, you bring up a couple things on the offensive side. First of all, Khalil Herbert again returned the opening kickoff against Liberty, injured his hamstring, didn't play the rest of the game, only had 8 carries for 49 yards in the game against Miami.
Played well, but you could tell he wasn't 100%.
Yeah.
And we're getting a question actually in the chat, which leads me to my next point. This is from Ryan B. Any thoughts on why Holston wasn't used more for early down situations?
None whatsoever.
Blackshear on third down. And look, real quick before you jump in, Jalen Holston, the third string running back, 4 carries, 36 yards, 2 touchdowns, arguably the biggest game of his career.
And one of his carries was limited because it was a 1-yard touchdown.
Right.
Who knows how – well, then again, it was Miami defended pretty well and tackled him right there.
It was so interesting. 4 carries, and they all came in the exact same situation. He threw a great block for a quarterback, either Hendon or Quincy, and then he got rewarded – by 2 straight carries, the second of which went for a touchdown.
Both times.
That's how it went down both times. He was running hard, and he was running violently too, man. That dude was running hard, and he was taking people out. And I tweeted, I said, he got rewarded for those good blocks with carries. And I had actually Caleb Farley liked that tweet, like a couple other players and things like that, or former players. So, like, football players recognize stuff like that. Like, he deserved to get rewarded. So, I was disappointed that, you know, once Virginia Tech, they were up 21-13, they tried to run the ball on their next drive. Hooker took a sack, and they had to settle for a field goal. But I was disappointed that with just the way he was running the ball that he didn't get more carries. Now, that being said, there was talk on the boards, and I haven't gone back and watched the tape. That's why we pay Brandon Patterson the big bucks. I'm sure he'll address this in his article tomorrow. There was some talk on the boards that at one point Miami was even lining up like 6 guys on the defensive line or 5.
I didn't see a whole lot of that.
I don't know.
I didn't see a whole lot of that.
I don't know. I'd have to go back and watch it. But in theory, yes. I think you reward the guy. I mean, at that point, you're winning the game because of him. Now give him a chance to win it in the fourth quarter.
Well, and it gets back to that thing of we don't know what they see in practice. Fuente, in his comments where he praised Holston, he did say, and we talked to him about ball security, but yeah, he ran great. So what are they seeing in practice?
Well, that's the thing. A lot of times you see those big violent runs. That's when guys fumble, right? Because they're just moving so fast and they're just not.
And for a guy to get playing time and get carries, the coaches have to trust him.
Right.
So why don't they trust him? Anyway,
briefly, would you like to see more of Jalen Holston in the offense moving forward?
If Herbert's not healthy, yes, I would. Yeah.
Yes, I agree with that. I think again. Give Blackshear more of a perimeter role, which they did a fair amount of Saturday.
And they put too much on that poor guy.
Yeah,
I know he's a smart guy, but He was working in August. He was working 50% at running back, 50% at wide receiver. Then COVID struck, and they were cross-training him on defense. And then he was out 10 to 14 days to COVID-related issues. He came back. They played him too much. Again, played somebody too much when they hadn't been practicing and they weren't in shape. And he got hurt. And so it was just this – so many bad things happened to him, you know, when he first got here. And it was a new offensive system, and he didn't have the spring, blah, of course.
Tater-tater.
Yeah. so just feel terrible for him. I don't know – I honestly don't know where I'd use him. I mean, he did his most damage at Rutgers in the passing game, but what do we just say about Hendon Hooker? He's not a very good passer. So –
he doesn't often get to the check down reads.
Exactly.
So it had to be a wheel route or something like that.
Exactly. So it's just Blackshear's strength, main strength, does not match up with Hendon Hooker's strength. Yeah. It's unfortunate.
Numbers in the rushing game for Virginia Tech. Hendon Hooker, 59 yards on the ground. Of course, his 53-yard touchdown run was kind of the highlight of the day for the running game.
How many yards did he lose?
He lost 53. He gained 112.
Yeah.
So 59 net yards, I should say. 49 yards for Herbert. Jalen Holston, 36 yards. And then Quincy Patterson had a rush for 9 yards. Raheem Blackshear, 6 carries for a net of 2 yards.
Jeez, really?
That's brutal.
Receiving-wise, Trey Turner. Another solid game through the air. 5 receptions, 86 yards. Tavion Robinson caught 5 passes. Caleb Smith had a 30-yard reception. So those are a couple numbers in the offense. We do need to take a break in just a moment. But last thing, Will, what was the defensive end for Miami? Who played well on Saturday? You said it was
Jalen Phillips.
And Chris, what was the other defensive end's name that we did not hear a lot of on Saturday?
Quincy Rocher.
And that is because?
Christian Darrisaw did a really good job.
So that was, I thought, one of the highlights of the game. By the way, really well done. We did that in sync there. I didn't know where we were going. That worked well. but Christian Darrisaw, we talked about it. I was really excited for this matchup of two potential NFL defensive ends going up against two tackles. Phillips got the best of Tenuta,
right.
But I hardly heard Quincy Roche's name. It right. felt like Darrisaw really held up.
The preliminary grades for Darrisaw were solid. So, he helped himself out.
Did you look at Tenuta's grade?
Yeah.
can you give us a ballpark range?
So here's the thing. Like the Tech offensive line, with the exception of Tenuta, their pass blocking
was pretty good.
Were really good.
Yeah.
So like every one of those sacks were either caused by Luke Tenuta or Hendon Hooker holding the ball entirely too long.
Yeah. And there were some blitzes there too.
And last thing to mention, James Mitchell was listed as active. He was not one of the players listed before the game. He was inactive, but he did not catch a pass.
Five snaps.
Is that all? Wow.
So one thing to keep an eye on moving forward. All right. We need to take a break here on episode 151 of the Tech Sideline Podcast. When we come back, an interesting hat from David Hale on the last 36 games for Virginia Tech against FBS programs. You're not going to want to miss this stat as we discuss. You're listening and watching to episode 151 of the Tech Sideline Podcast, brought to you by the Fisher Law Firm.
If you have received a DUI or other traffic-related offense, the road ahead can seem uncertain. Here at Fisher Law Firm, we have a team that is with you every step of the way. We have the experience that comes along with having defended more than 30,000 criminal and traffic cases statewide, and the expertise to get the job done. Call anytime, day or evening, for your free consultation or a complimentary copy of my book. Don't forget to ask us about our free appeal guarantee. To learn how we can help solve your problem, check us out at fisherlegal.com. This is Jonathan Fisher, class of 98. Let's go Hokies.
Welcome back in to episode 151 of the Tech Sideline Podcast. Evan Hughes here with Chris Coleman, Will Stewart, Malcolm Stewart behind the scenes producing, as always, Tech Sideline Podcast, each and every show presented by the Southeast Regional Training Center. Will has the shirt for this year. Of course, if you want to support Virginia Tech Wrestling, go to southeastrtc.com and you can help support Virginia Tech Wrestling. Look at that shirt, Will. A little dry fit.
Sweet, man. I had to give it to Malcolm, because at my age and my current weight, I don't wear a white shirt like this, one of these clingy white things. So very nice. So if you donate to the Southeast Regional Training Center, you'll get this very cool shirt. Now, be aware, you're going to have to be ready to talk wrestling. If you're wearing this thing out and somebody sees you, you know, you better come correct, man. You better, you know, it's,
they're going to expect you to know what you're talking about.
First of all, donate. Yeah. Second of all, pay some attention and be able to talk about it.
Here's the talking point. If you're wearing that shirt, you can talk about how Tony Robey just signed another incredible recruiting class.
Yeah, small class, but really good.
So, Tech Sideline Podcast also presented by Campus Emporium and, of course, Southeast Regional Training Center.
Yeah.
All right. So, in just a little bit, we're going to get to your questions on YouTube. If you're watching live, you have a question for Will and Chris, drop them in the chat and I will read them in just a moment. But yesterday I woke up, was reading Twitter and you know, try and follow as many media professionals as I can. And I came across a tweet from David Hale, who does an incredible job of covering the ACC. And I wanted to get your thoughts and perspective off of this stat that he pointed out on Twitter yesterday. It reads, Justin Fuente was 15-5. In his first 20 games against FBS opponents at Virginia Tech. In the 36 since then, the Hokies are 17-19, including losses to Old Dominion, Duke by 35, and Liberty. VT has 8 losses in that span in games it was tied or ahead in the fourth quarter. Frank Beamer's last 36 games against FBS opponents, 19-17. What are your thoughts when you hear all of those numbers?
Well, I remember at the end of the Beamer tenure, yeah, that was a frustrating part. We were Tech was a 500 football team, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Justin Fuente gets here, and bam, we're not. We're 1-10 games and 9 games, and everybody's like, woohoo.
Coming within a whisker of winning an ACC championship.
Exactly. And now where Tech is basically right there where they were when Beamer retired. In terms of wins,
I don't know. There's a whole lot you can. Yeah. That tweet stands alone, and I think any further commentary on it will just delve into coach bashing.
Right.
The tweet speaks for itself.
It was, I had trouble trying to formulate a question off that more. So just a statement. Just,
hey, listen to this.
It was an interesting thought, and you know, yeah.
I used to point out stuff like that in my articles. I would, you know, from like 2012 when Tech started to suddenly lose a lot more football games,
yeah.
I would take slices of history like that.
Well, I used to do, like, in the last part of the Beamer era, we were so horrible at home. Tech was so horrible at home.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, I just want to win home games again. And then Fuente gets here in that first year, we go like 6-1 at home I'm like, finally we're winning home
pounding
games.
Pounding teams at
right,
home.
Right, yeah,
man.
Exactly. The interesting one I found yesterday, I put it in my article. You know, it popped into my head when 0-2 Nebraska was playing 0-3 Penn State, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I remember in 1999 when Florida State was number one all year and
Penn State was up there.
And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm like, I'm pretty sure Penn State was in that group. I think they started out like 8-0. And then I know Nebraska finished number 3 because I know we were waiting on the result of the Nebraska game on that last day when Tech beat Boston College.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I looked it up and like Florida State was number 1 from end to end. Tech finished number 2. Nebraska finished number 3. Penn State was as high as number 2,
right.
I think, at one point.
Yeah.
And those four teams now are a combined 7-15. And Virginia Tech is responsible for over half the wins.
I know. Virginia Tech's got 4 of those 7 wins.
That's amazing.
And the only reason Nebraska has a win
is because they beat Penn State.
Maybe not the only reason, but
no, that's pretty much where they got it from.
Yeah. That was one of my favorite stats you put in your article, actually, this week was the stats. You threw in Tennessee there, too.
Tennessee is also 2-4 this year, and I think they got up as high as number 3.
They were coming off a national championship.
They were coming off a national championship.
They won the 98 national championship.
It's just like –
Phil Fulmer.
My gosh.
Who's now the AD at Tennessee, I believe.
All those schools have like double the resources of Virginia Tech. And I'm not saying we have an excuse of losing to Liberty, but...
You got misery.
Because we don't. But like, there's no way Penn State should be 0-4. Like, for all this like praise that Franklin gets for recruiting, well, apparently he forgot to recruit a quarterback during that whole thing.
Apparently that's the problem, and his offensive coordinator is not able to compensate for it.
Well, keep in mind, their offensive coordinator just left. It's a new offensive coordinator because the old OC is now the head coach at Old Dominion, taking over for Bobby Wilder.
That's a good point, and so they didn't have the spring with a new offense. And I'll point out, there's still a perception amongst Tech fans that Fuente's $12.5 million buyout is a lot of money. That's if you're still thinking in 1990s terms, which yes. I think the fan base does in everything. We always think in 1990s terms.
Yeah.
It's not. It's nothing. James Franklin's buyout is $38.5 million.
$38 million.
I mean, Justin Fuente's buyout is perfectly normal for a college coach these days.
So, last thought before we get to questions on YouTube. Again, this comes from Evan Hughes scrolling on Twitter yesterday and going through and saw that Dan Wolkin wrote an article for USA Today. And he wrote an opinion piece that was headlined this, and I gave it a read. It's an opinion that says, Virginia Tech has become the college football team that can't close the deal. Kind of talks about Virginia Tech and a couple of – it's about a two-minute read.
I skimmed it.
Reason I bring it up is because every now and then you see a national article written, whether it's USA Today or something, on the Hokies. 50,000-foot view from a national perspective, Will – what do you think the perception is from a national perspective of Virginia Tech football, and does that align with the expectation of the Virginia Tech football fan base?
I think that the national perception is that the program in terms of wins and losses isn't as good as it should be. Remember Kirk Herbstreit last year? I think it was after the Duke loss last year when Herbstreit basically – you know, and I don't, by the way, I think this is incorrect. Herbstreit said, I just don't think Fuente fits the culture there. So that was the first indication to me that somebody nationally was going, man, what's wrong in Blacksburg? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to answer the exact question you asked. I think there's still a perception that Virginia Tech has a lot of potential as a program and should be doing better. I'm not sure that perception is wrong. We're down in the minutiae, and we know that they've fallen behind in some areas, and facilities and staffing. They got caught with their pants down. And unfortunately, these are things that happen. They unfold over 5 or 10 years. And then when you realize your pants are around your ankles, it takes you 5 or 10 years to pull them back up.
Yeah.
So next thing you know, 20 years have gone by. And you're Virginia Tech basketball. You haven't won games for 20 years. That's a reference to 1987 to 2003 when Virginia Tech just didn't win basketball games. I'm just rambling, trying to say interesting things at this point. So
I actually don't know if there is a perception. Like, I bet your average college football fan doesn't even know what Virginia Tech's record is right now.
I know that Virginia Tech just doesn't get talked about anymore.
I don't know Kansas State's record.
I know they're having a pretty good year, I think.
Are they really?
Yeah,
okay, really
I think.
Good. But I mean, I don't know.
Right.
Because I don't care.
What's Boise State's
so
record?
I think the perception is Virginia Tech right now nationally is a ho-hum, I don't care how they're doing.
Well, so I think they're in the same group with Kansas State and Boise State, teams that were really good in the past, but nobody's really paying attention to them now.
There we go. Robert chimes in. Kansas State is 4-2. Thank you, Robert.
Okay, not bad.
I did know they beat a big team earlier in the year. I forget.
West Virginia,
Oklahoma.
Maybe?
Oklahoma, that's right.
Remember they were down by like 30?
So the wind came
sweeping
down the plane.
They were down by a lot of points and came back, yeah.
So, again, interesting perspective. Really good podcast so far. And you know what? The best part hasn't even gotten here yet. When we get to check in with the viewers the here on Tech Sideline. Time for some questions. We will dive in. Yes, thank you, Justin. Oklahoma. Yep, everyone's – see, our YouTube chat knows what's going on with Kansas State. So that just means – we need to keep up with the Wildcats. So, all right, if you have a question, even if you haven't dropped one in yet, go ahead and do it now. I'm going to start at the top, go all the way at the bottom. Question from Justin Thomas. I'm assuming not the golfer Justin Thomas, who I thought was going to win the Masters this weekend. Still shot very well. Justin asks, going to get the question out of the way early. Does the Will Muschamp firing change anything with Whit Babcock's office with respect to Coach Fu's future?
So, I think who was it that fired their coach about 3 weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago?
Utah State.
That really? Didn't really register on the national consciousness, though. And I don't even know the details of it. So let's put that aside. The Will Muschamp firing is hashtag first. An athletic director actually went there and did that. And that changes. I think that changes how other athletic directors around the country. I don't think anybody wanted to be first in COVID year.
No.
And, you know, leave it to the SEC, man. You know, they go first. And so what was the question exactly?
The exact question was, Going to get the question out of the way early. Does the Will Muschamp firing change anything in Whit Babcock's office with respect to Coach Few's future?
I will say in general, it makes it more permissible around the country to consider getting rid of your coach because now somebody's done it.
It does. Do they still have the same athletic director at South Carolina? Like the old baseball coach?
I don't even know who their athletic director is.
I think it was it Ray Tanner? He was their longtime baseball coach. They made him AD, and he's the one who hired Muschamp.
Evan is punching keys. Hugh Freeze, baby. I'm telling you, that's what's going to happen.
Well, he just signed a contract extension last week through 2026.
Ray
Tanner?
Ray Tanner, okay. That's their old baseball coach who was made athletic director.
Hugh Freeze, baby.
So, but I'm pretty sure he's the one who hired Muschamp. So, like, this guy has not shown – he has not shown the ability that he knows anything about football. So, I don't think Muschamp is a good coach. I also don't know that like, this year – is the year to fire him or anybody because for all the reasons we talked about earlier, right? Now, that being said, you can compare the South Carolina job to the Virginia Tech job, and, like, South Carolina has more money. They have more fans. They're in a better recruiting region. All that's to their advantage. But they're also in the SEC East, and they have no chance to win it. So if you go there as a head coach – you go there to try and win 8 games and then move on to a better job. That's the reason to take the South Carolina job.
You know, and the Hugh Freeze fits that profile. You know, he can coach in the SEC.
He can coach in the SEC, sure. I don't know whether that makes Witt's decision easier or harder. I don't know if it has anything to do with it. I do know that if I was a coach and – whatever school came after me is their head coach this year, and I didn't know whether it was going to be spring practice or not. And let's say they offered me a 5-year contract. I would say, I want a 6-year contract. I want an extra year because I don't know if we're going to be able to practice this spring. I think that's what I would say if I was a prospective head coach. I'd be like, look, this first year might be a throwaway year because I'm trying to change systems and then I'm not going to actually have a chance to practice the system. I can't be held accountable for year one. Therefore, I demand an extra year on the end of my contract. That's what I'd be saying.
Yeah,
if
but
I was
if you're coaching
coach.
In the SEC, man,
I want Chris Coleman as my agent. a couple other comments. Luke Hamley writes in, can't keep using no spring practice as an excuse. You know, I'm curious to get your thoughts on it. I appreciate the comment, Luke.
Well,
you know, because I think spring practice is very important to development. I think that is, across the country, right?
Well, Brandon Patterson is a very smart football mind, and he pointed out that teams that are most compromised by missing spring practice are those that change coordinators and or head coaches. A lot of teams, you know, we've talked about this. LSU, I think you mentioned earlier in the podcast, they changed defensive coordinators and rolled out there and got smoked a few times. And so
you can't use it as an excuse for losing to Liberty.
And you can't use it as an excuse for bad decision-making within a game.
Right.
You know, is missing spring practice your excuse for not scoring any points in the last 5 possessions? Yeah, you know.
Maybe because Hendon Hooker didn't get a chance to develop. But I don't know if he would have been developed anyway.
Yeah.
My bigger issue, of course, with the program is not everybody looks exactly how they should look or questionable decisions, questionable medical decisions.
Yeah.
Things like that. Yeah.
Question from Robert. Do you expect any AD announcements regarding football or athletics overall after the BOV meeting occurring yesterday and today?
Announcements? I think when I interviewed Whit a few weeks back, about a month ago, that he made a reference to late this year, early next year for the Capitol campaign announcement, which was supposed to happen at the last spring game. Mm-hmm. So I don't think any sort of announcement is imminent. I think you'll hear message board traffic about things. I don't think an announcement is imminent, but I do think you'll hear something at the end of the year or the beginning of next year.
I think a timing right now when you've lost 3 or 4, you've lost to Liberty. I think the timing will be poor because you announce it on Twitter and all the responses will be
Fire Fuente.
Right. So I think you let the season end. You let people calm down a little bit. And then you announce it. Or, like, if something crazy happens and you do change head coaches, you know, you accompany the announcement of a hiring of a new coach with all of this. Here's our plan. Here's exactly how much money we're going to spend on support staff. You let the whole fan base know your future intentions of your program, how much you're spending, exactly what you're going to do. Finally, can we see some pictures of the Student Athlete Nutrition Center in the weight room, things like that, you know?
So another piece of advice I would give Whit Babcock is when rolling out this $50 million capital campaign for Castle Coliseum and clearly some other football things, I would emphasize, how is the Castle renovation going to benefit the football program if it is? Mm-hmm. You know, it's possible that the $50 million reno will include all the stuff we hear about on the lot one side of Castle, larger concourses, some sort of luxury box, et cetera, et cetera. You going to do anything over on the Jamerson side to help out the football program that's part of that $50 million?
We criticize because we don't know.
Yeah, we're not being told anything. You know, so if that's part of the Castle reno, make that clear.
Yep. A couple more questions. Evan Norris writes, how do you see the Virginia Tech recruiting staff responding to a Penn State 0-4 start for Virginia recruiting and with a recruiting dead zone ranging until April now?
Is it until April now?
I did not know that. I thought it was through January. If that is through April, that is news to me.
Pete's sake.
Well, so there we go. Like, I don't think we're going to have spring practice.
Okay, I don't know. I thought it was through January.
I thought it was through January too. It's possible that I missed it, but I don't know. But how do you respond if you're Virginia Tech? Quite frankly, there is no response. You can try, but it doesn't matter. I mean, Tech is 4-4, and the national perception is that the program's getting worse. Recruiting's not going great anyway. Recruits get on Twitter and see the fans trashing the program. We all know how this is going to end. It's just a matter of when.
Well, it did get it over the weekend. It got a move to April 15th, according to Evan Norris and Jeremiah Davis chiming into the chat.
You negative recruit Penn State. You say, look at all these recruits James Franklin is bringing in, and they're 0-4. Something's wrong with that program. But in the end, they have better facilities, better history, and that dude is one hell of a salesman.
They have enough talent in their program to win 10 games next year. Florida State, all those teams that we made fun of earlier, we talked about earlier, Florida State, yes, even Florida State is about bad as they've been. Florida State, Tennessee, maybe not Tennessee, but like Penn State, Florida State, programs like that, they're awful right now, but they also have the talent to win 10 games next year if everything falls together. I don't think Tech does. Like, Tech is better right now than those teams, but still their ceiling is nowhere near as high.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, last thing too, you know, we've talked about the coaching staff today. William Burr writes in, why are Hokie fans so negative and always want Coach Fuente or the OC fired every week we lose, even when it's close? And as soon as we win a game, even when it's close, no one says anything. Evan chimes in and says, I'm really excited to see how well this defense system works when our 20/21 guys get in there. So, you know, I don't really know if there's a answer to that, but I just, you know, in the chat, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of different opinions in the chat today.
You know, I mean, Tech won a lot of games for a long time. And I think it's natural. You know, Cornelson caught the heat before Fuente ever did. Rightly or wrongly. I said my piece on him earlier. I think he's a good enough offensive coordinator, but not a good enough quarterback developer. If he was a good enough quarterback developer, I don't think we'd be complaining about his offensive coordinating. That's my personal opinion. I also think, you know, Tech fans were just kind of used to complaining about the offensive coordinator because we've been doing it for 20 years, right? So I think that's part of it. I don't know. Like, I don't pay attention to other fan bases, so I don't know if Tech fans are more or less negative than other fan bases.
Yeah, I don't know either.
I do know. I don't know. I've got some friends from college, and sometimes there's a group text thing going on, and I love them to death. Don't get me wrong, but they're the type that you never hear from them unless Virginia Tech's losing a football game, right?
People tend to get more vocal when they're angry,
right? Right. And I finally had to tell them earlier this year. I was like, guys, if you're only going to talk to me about football when Virginia Tech loses, then just don't talk to me.
Yeah.
And I hated to say it, but I don't even know if they thought I was serious, but I don't know if that's I don't know if, like I said, I don't know if Virginia Tech is more or less negative than other schools, because I don't pay attention to other fan bases. But
well, Frank laid some eggs, you know, lost to Miami of Ohio in 1997, lost to Temple in 1998, lost to JMU in 2010. Mm-hmm. But they always bounced back from that, sometimes in that exact same season.
Right. Well, and the thing is, like, when Virginia Tech lost to Temple, I mean, I remember where I was when I found out. I was a family reunion in Salisbury, North Carolina. We're in a restaurant getting barbecue, of course, as you would in southern North Carolina, and I see the score go across the bottom line, and I'm like, that can't be accurate, that's a misprint. And I get back to Virginia, and turns out it's true, right? But I was like, huh, how about that? But I knew there was nothing wrong with the program. They just had a bad day.
Yeah.
Historically, once a generation, really, really, really bad day. But there was nothing indicative that there was anything wrong with the program.
Right.
So it's like, it didn't, like, losing individual micro football games don't bother me. Like, I don't like losing to Liberty, don't get me wrong, but I look at losses like that and I think, do we lose because we had a bad day, or is there something wrong with the program? And I think people get the sense that there's something wrong with the program now, as opposed to, oh, we just had a bad day.
Because there's now one of these per season, ODU, and ODU was a bad football team that year.
Right,
right. And then Duke. And
Duke was a bad football team.
Yeah.
Duke did not make a bowl game last year, I don't think.
Oh, they were horrible down the stretch until, of course, they played Miami. And Miami had packed it in.
Right, so they
beat
Virginia Tech and then tanked and then beat Miami.
Yeah.
But real quick, I want to make sure we get this right. CBS Sports' Dennis Dodd is reporting that the NCAA dead period, which has been in place since March because of the coronavirus pandemic, will be extended through April 15, 2021. Dodd said the NCAA Council is expected to approve the move at its meeting November 18th. So it's not official yet.
So over a year.
A year of kids not being recruited.
Not being able to visit, and you can't visit them. Now, I will say this. I know for a fact that I know of one story where a certain coaching staff went in home with a recruit back in the late spring. I'm not going to say where it was or what recruit or which staff. It was not a Power 5 staff.
Not a Power 5 program.
Yeah. So that stuff is going on. It's one of those things, though, if you get caught doing that, like, you're better off buying a recruit for $250,000 than you are getting caught walking into his home, because people will shame you.
Yeah, the court of public opinion will not be kind to you.
Right.
And this is just another case of the NCAA just making decisions and pushing all the damage down to the schools.
All right, a couple of comments. Luke Hamley says Salisbury, North Carolina is a great place. Eric Fisher says he blames Greg Roberts for the Temple game. He said pregame he would eat his tie if we lost.
Did he eat it?
And it's hard to eat. Jim Pennington writes, TSL needs Spurtle as a sponsor. There you have it. Chat today.
Lucinda's probably blown her entire advertising budget on that.
So I think I read that you see all those Tax Shaver and Spurtle commercials, and that those are commercials that are purchased at a very low rate and are backfill. And then you try to sell more expensive ads on top of them and not show them.
Uh-huh.
And the reason you're seeing so many of those is that the ACC network has not been able to sell better, more expensive ads.
Why do you think that is?
I wonder why.
Oh, gosh.
That's a topic of a whole separate podcast.
You know, we are an hour and 18 minutes in. So, as always, my final question of the day is to Chris Coleman, our managing editor. What's a normal leak week? For those who have never listened to a TSL podcast before, what can they expect on TechSideline.com?
Gosh, well, I'm going to start researching my Inside the Numbers article.
So first thing is after we produce the podcast, I sit down and wrap up my Monday Thoughts article.
I'm going to start researching Inside the Numbers. There'll be press conferences today, so Corey and Jake will have articles later today. There'll be press conference tomorrow, so there'll be a couple articles from Corey and Jake.
Yeah,
tomorrow.
For people that don't know, Fuente goes on Monday and players go on Tuesday.
Yeah, and let's see. Brandon Patterson will do his review either Tuesday or Wednesday. My Inside the Numbers will be either Tuesday and Wednesday.
Game preview
podcast on Thursday.
Thursday.
A couple of Jason Stame articles later in the week. A Corey Van Dyke article on Friday. A Friday Q&A.
And Brandon Patterson's scouting report.
Yeah. Now, we don't know how the Pitt game is going to affect that. Now, let's be clear. We've heard there's a chance the Pitt game could get canceled. Pitt's program was shut down. They didn't play Georgia Tech over the weekend. Virginia Tech might not play Pitt this coming weekend. Virginia Tech might be off 2 weeks in a row. We don't know if or when that will be announced. It'll probably be announced as soon as we finish the podcast on Thursday, previewing the Pitt game.
Yeah, we'll do our work.
And yeah, that would make the most sense. But if somehow like the Pitt game gets canceled on Wednesday, then we'll probably just do a basketball preview for Thursday's podcast.
There you have it. That's coming up on TextOnline.com this week. And let's end the podcast on a light note. I was going through Twitter to see if there's been any news or anything from the press conference. Nothing yet, but you guys know Coastal Carolina's undefeated, having a great season in football, right? They're in the top 15. They were an FCS school a couple of years ago, the Chanticleers. So there is a gentleman by the name of Scott Eisberg on Twitter. He's a sports director in Charleston, South Carolina for a TV station. And he reached out to Jamie Chadwell, who's the coach at South Carolina, about the head coaching vacancy.
And wait a minute. Jamie Chadwell is
the head coach at Coastal Carolina.
Yeah. So he's reaching out about the vacancy at South Carolina, trying to get a statement. And Coach Chadwell texts back, quote, "Right now, my wife's fan has a brake light out. I'm focused on trying to fix it without getting her upset. I've got bigger issues to worry about," with the big smiley face.
Well, see, if you,
I absolutely love that. I think that's just very lighthearted.
If you got a bigger staff, then you could have a staff member take care of that, right?
That's right.
Coastal Carolina.
That was just a screenshot of the text too. So, anyways, I thought that was hilarious. Just a lighthearted way to close the podcast today. All right, Will, any final thoughts before we sign off?
No, I don't really think I have anything to add. Appreciate everybody who subscribes, and if you don't subscribe, $8.49 a month, give it a shot for a month. And if you don't think it's worth it, even if they're losing football games, if you don't think it's worth it, I'll give you your $8.50 back, and you can go get a combo meal. Or two Wendy's four, but 4 for 4s.
That's a good deal right there. All right, well, that'll do it for us here on episode 151 of the TextOnline podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, please be sure to hit the like button and also hit subscribe as well. We appreciate those that chimed in the YouTube chat today. All right, for our managing editor, he is Chris Coleman, our founder and general manager, Will Stewart, the best podcast producer in the land, Malcolm Stewart behind the scenes. I'm your podcast host, Evan Hughes, saying so long. Thanks so much for watching and listening to episode 151 of the TextOnline podcast. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you on Thursday.